Good afternoon. We're going to call back to order the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We're continuing from our hearings that we had earlier today as our work sessions. I have one bill that we had another public hearing scheduled for. I have one individual that I need to go ahead and get up here, so I'm going to go ahead and open up the public hearing on 2403A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2403A allows a law enforcement agency to remove a hidden compartment from a vehicle that has been forfeited and to be reimbursed for the expense associated with the removal out of proceeds of selling the vehicle. There is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Lieutenant, thank you for being here. Sorry for the delay from this morning. Since you're the only one scheduled for this, I think this would be pretty quick. If you'll sign in and give us your summary of what the bill does, and we'll move from there.
Thank you. My name is Mike Dingham, and I'm a lieutenant with the Oregon State Police. I oversee our drug enforcement section. What 2403 is intended to do is help law enforcement deal with vehicles that hit that have hidden compartments. And what we're talking about is the vehicles that aftermarket compartments are put into them that drug smugglers, for example, are using to conceal drugs, money, and weapons. They tend to be rather sophisticated. The modifications oftentimes will compromise the integrity of the safety features of the vehicle. And what we do is when we come across these cases and we seize one of these vehicles, we're kind of in a dilemma as to what we do with them in terms of, if we move them through a forfeiture process, what do we do with the vehicle if we sell it? What do we do with it if we're going to keep it? What do we do with the vehicle if, for example, if you wanted to repair the compartment, if the cost of that compartment exceeds the value of the vehicle? Initially, the concept that we had drafted when it was House Bill 2403 prior to the amendment was to deal with the vehicle similarly to like how we deal with firearms when they're forfeited and deal with the vehicles as contraband. But as we started taking a close look at the provisions of dealing with the contraband, there's several scenarios that come up. For example, if you've got a bank or a financial institution that's a lien holder on the vehicle, if we were to deal with it as contraband, let's say they had $10,000 still invested with the vehicle, how do we deal with that situation? So that and a couple other scenarios weren't working very well with it, so we sat down with some stakeholders and talked about some options on what would be the best way to deal with it. The other thing that law enforcement wanted to make sure is, two, we want to make sure that the vehicles aren't getting reintroduced back into the general circulation of vehicles where they can be used again to transport contraband, or worse yet, that we know that when the smugglers are done using them, they don't keep them indefinitely, especially if we come across them, they'll get back into the circulation, they'll get auctioned off, and you could have an innocent owner in an apple with a vehicle that has a hidden compartment in it, not knowing about it and not knowing that it may have compromised the safety vehicle. So we wanted to talk about making it a policy decision that prior to selling these vehicles or reintroducing them back into circulation that we require that those compartments be disabled, but write it in a way that law enforcement wasn't responsible for the cost of doing that. So for example, we seize a vehicle as proceed or an instrumentality of prohibited conduct as is laid out in the civil and criminal forfeiture statutes. And then once it was forfeited, if we were to decide to sell the vehicle and then take those proceeds for the distribution, that we would disable that compartment prior to the auction, deduct the cost of that disabling from the proceeds, and then distribute based on what was left over. Now, the other scenario was, let's say the vehicle's forfeited, and we wanted to keep the vehicle for law enforcement purposes, i.e. an undercover vehicle, that under the forfeiture statute, we would have to, take the blue book value of that vehicle and distribute those proceeds in order to keep the vehicle. But what we would do in this case, as it's laid out, we would get an estimate as to what it would cost to disable that compartment, deduct that from that blue book value, and then distribute based on that. The other scenario that comes up, and this comes up rather frequently, especially lately, and if I didn't mention that, these vehicles with these compartments are the predominant method that are being used to smuggle significant quantities of drugs, through Oregon and, from in-state or out-of-state, as well as in-state. So lost track on when the last scenario I was going to do, but some of these compartments are so sophisticated that, for example, you put a false floor in it, so you've totally redone the whole back end of a vehicle that it there's a significant cost to removing that or disabling it in a manner that returns that vehicle back to a safe condition. That cost could exceed the value of that vehicle, so we'd like that. We wanted to be able to have the ability in that instance, if the vehicle's forfeited, that we would just destroy it and take it to a scrapyard, junkyard. We would get the proceeds based on that and then distribute through the forfeiture formulas based on whatever proceeds were left over. So in a nutshell, that's what we're trying to do, is just make sure that those compartments are being removed before they get reintroduced back to the public, if that's where they end up.
All right. Lieutenant, thank you for your testimony. Any questions for the Lieutenant? Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on House Bill 2403? Not seeing anyone come forward, we'll close that public hearing on the work session on House Bill 2403.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2403A to the floor with due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2403A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair will carry this bill. And we'll close that public hearing, work session, I should say. And we're going to go back to our continuation of the public hearing we were having. I've looked at the list to make certain that I get everyone in that wanted to give testimony today. And I'm going to ask whoever does have cell phones to please turn them off at this time. The next two individuals I have that are proponents for the bill is Lauren Simon, and I believe it's Letty Merritt. If you two would like to come forward, please. I believe everyone else that is scheduled to give testimony is in opposition, and so. Thank you very much for being here and coming back. I apologize because of our schedule, we weren't able to take all of the testimony this morning.
Okay. I believe the other person that was going to testify is not here. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Letty Merritt, and I live in Southwest Portland, and I urge you to pass House Bill 2827. For me personally, House Bill 2827 will determine whether I have a chance at some civil justice. I am 39 years old, and I am a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. I was sexually abused by several male relatives when I was a little girl. The abuse began when I was 6 years old, and it did not stop until I was 13. Although I was born in Portland, Oregon, and I was raised in Beaverton, Oregon, I am of Mexican descent. I was raised in a family culture of secrets. My reality was one where some of my male relatives and uncles would act out their sick fantasies on my sister and I. It was a confusing existence where older male relatives would prey on the quiet, young, innocent little girls. Little innocent girls who looked up and adored them. Through the abuse, these relatives would convey to me that I was special. Yet no one would talk about the specialness that had just taken place. It was very confusing to me, but it was my reality, and I understood that I was to pretend it was acceptable. The sexual abuse broke me. It shattered my confidence, my self-esteem, and my self-worth. I believed that what happened to me did not matter. I believed that I did not matter. I learned that if I acted like an intelligent, strong, and outgoing person, that I would eventually become that person. On the outside, I convinced others that I was strong. But internally, I did not believe that I had any real self-worth. I coexisted in two separate worlds. One world, I tried to become the person that I believe I should become, and in the other world, the ugly secrets existed behind locked doors. I graduated from Portland State University in the late 1990s at the age of 29. It was during those college years, after almost two decades of harboring these dark secrets of childhood sexual abuse and of struggling with self-esteem issues, that I broached the subject of my childhood sexual abuse with a counselor. And when I say I broached the subject, I merely asked the counselor that if there was any possibility that my personal struggles were somehow connected to my past of being sexually abused as a little girl. I was in counseling to work on issues I believe were more pressing because I was very much in denial about the effects of my childhood history of sexual abuse. More years came and went. I married a wonderful man when I was 32 years old. One thing was clear to me, although I could not explain why at the time, I did not want to have children. Subconsciously, I did not want any other child to experience my childhood.
My husband has provided me with
a loving, stable, and secure environment. We bought a house, we adopted 2 dogs, and my life was complete and fulfilling. Yet the dark secrets from my childhood past began to haunt me again. The perpetrators, these relatives of mine, were now grown men with daughters and granddaughters of their own. My molesters would talk to me at family functions. I would watch them interact with other young girls, family relatives, and I would wonder how many more family members had been abused and how many more were still being abused. No matter how much I tried to deny the existence of my sexual abuse, the dark secrets infiltrated my married life. 4 years into my marriage, I embarked on a 3-year intensive counseling journey and finally shared all of the shameful, dark, painful secrets of my childhood sexual abuse to my therapist. In 2008, 2 years into my intensive therapy, I found my voice. I found the courage to say, no one had a right to sexually abuse me. I became that strong woman I had always wanted to become. I confronted the 3 living male relatives who had sexually abused me. 2 of them apologized for abusing me. The other one is still in denial, hiding behind his alcoholic past. There has been a significant monetary cost to confronting the abusers. Even though my husband and I are fortunate enough to have health insurance and some medical insurance, some of the counseling, group counseling, was provided through a federal grant through the Portland Women's Crisis Line. We have still had to pay over $5,000 out of pocket for my individual therapy. The non-monetary cost has been even greater, because I have been ostracized from the family for speaking out about sexual abuse. I have been called a lying whore for exposing these dark secrets. I knew there would be backlash from the family, and it took me many years to summon the emotional and financial reserves to expose the dark secrets and shame of sexual abuse. I am making a difference. I have sent a clear message to my family that childhood sexual abuse will not be tolerated, and that the culture of secrecy and darkness in our family that has allowed it to happen for 2 generations must stop now. I will not be silenced any longer. I will not cover up for these molesters. What my relatives did to my sister and I was wrong, and those who abused me need to take responsibility and be held accountable. House Bill 2827 will stop the culture of sexual violence in my family. For me personally, House Bill 2827 will determine whether I have a chance at some civil justice. Thank you.
Thank you for coming forward. Yeah, are there any questions for our panel? Thank you again for coming and sharing. All right, I have 4 other people who are scheduled to testify, at least have signed up. Margaret Hoffman, Alan Tressider, Mark Seeger, and Ken McLeod. If we can bring up a 4th chair, that would be appropriate.
Record. My name is Alan Tressider, and I'm before you today representing the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, commonly referred to as the Mormon Church. We are opposed to House Bill 2827, but before I give you my very brief remarks, I wanted to just reflect on 2 things that were said this morning. I have, as most of you know, I've roamed these halls for some 32 years, so I am rarely surprised by anything that happens. I was momentarily taken aback by 2 things this morning. One was Aaron Olson's comment that, of course, you shouldn't include public bodies because there's a Tort Claims Act, and therefore we should never go there. That makes absolutely no sense to me. By far, if our intent here is to stop childhood sexual abuse, and that should be our intent, is to stop childhood sexual abuse, then certainly you would want to include the public sector. There is far more sexual abuse happens in the public sector than in the private sector. That's just statistically true. Now, there are a couple of problems in the public sector if you're a plaintiff. One, there's a 180-day tort claim notice, so you have to give notice of your intent to sue within 180 days. I would actually argue that's very good public policy, because the best justice is the justice that begins and happens as near as to the event as possible, that memories are clear, that records are there, that both defendant and plaintiff can face each other and a jury of their peers and settle the disagreement. So I would argue that this bill, were it to go forward, and I hope it doesn't, but were it to go forward, would include public bodies within its scope. The second thing that was said this morning, which again strained my interest, was former Representative Clark's argument that he does not target institutions of trust. Now, that's interesting, because if you go to at least three different websites maintained by Representative Clark, there is MormonAbuse.com, BoyScoutAbuse.com, and PriestAbuse.com, which I think are clearly designed at, quote, institutions of trust, and offer his services as they might be available. Let me just talk a little bit about, first, I need to tell you that without question, the Mormon Church has zero tolerance for child abuse. There are no second chances, and people are excommunicated from the church if found guilty of child sexual abuse. There is a rationale, there's a very clear legal rationale for statute of limitations. You want prompt claims to remove dangerous people, products, or situations. So you want to improve conditions so that no one else is injured. That happens when claims are prompt. Good legal systems seek accurate and quick adjudication. It is very difficult, if not impossible, to defend claims that are 30, 40, or 50 years old. It's a one-way legal system. The plaintiff has all the memories fade, documents are not retained, and many of these claims are filed long after the alleged perpetrator has died. Adjudication cannot be fair and accurate when the only other person present in the alleged abuse is deceased, and so you only hear one side of the story. Since the first of these claims began to be brought, the Mormon Church has reacted very quickly and affirmatively to educate not only its elders, but its community at large, that parents and children are informed and taught about signs of sexual abuse and what is appropriate and what is inappropriate. We have taken very affirmative steps to make it clear that we do not tolerate abuse in the church. And we think that has had a significant effect on at least the awareness among both children and parents of childhood sexual abuse. The last thing I would say about this bill is, I clearly don't want the bill to go forward, but should it go forward, this bill is retroactive, and at a minimum, you ought to repeal the retroactivity clause. With that, I'll be glad to answer any questions, or wait until my colleagues testify, and then we can answer any questions.
Yeah, I would like the panel to give their testimony, then we'll open it up for everyone. Whoever would like to go next, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Prusnansky and members of the committee. My name is Margaret Hoffman. I'm an attorney with Schwabe Williamson and Wyatt in Portland. I have represented the Archdiocese of Portland and Oregon for a number of years on a myriad of claims, including allegations of misconduct with children by clergy and or members of the staff. In addition to being a lawyer, I am also the mother of a 16-year-old boy, and I'm the wife of a volunteer coach. Abuse of children is a societal problem. It cannot be justified or tolerated under any circumstances. Our laws regarding child abuse should be written with two goals in mind. The first is promoting policies and procedures directed toward the prevention of child abuse. The second is fundamental fairness. Fundamental fairness in providing opportunities for redress equally available to all children who have been victimized, and fundamental fairness in respecting the rights of the accused as well as of the victim. Not all those accused of child abuse are guilty. House Bill 2827 accomplishes neither of these goals. In fact, it goes counter to them. First, House Bill 2827 does not prevent child abuse. Enabling lawsuits decades after the fact does not stop child abuse. Allowing lawsuits against an employer or a sponsoring organization for child abuse by one of its members 30, 40, or 50 years later does not prevent child abuse. In fact, extending the statute of limitations could have the opposite effect. Unreported perpetrators may continue abusing children while a victim waits years to bring a lawsuit. We need to create safe environments such that children are encouraged to report, discuss, and deal with abuse as contemporaneously as possible so that we stop perpetrators before they harm others. Second, House Bill 2827 is fundamentally unfair in two respects. First, it fails to provide opportunities equally to all children who have been victimized. If the intent of the bill is to address child abuse, why then are the vast majority of children at risk, those in the public schools, left out? The gentlemen who have testified here this morning provide compelling accounts of their personal experiences of abuse, abuse which was done by members of the private sector. I submit to you that if my son, who attends Portland Public Schools, is abused by a trusted teacher, the effects of the abuse on him are no different than the effects of abuse on people in the private sector. The consequences to him would be indistinguishable from the consequences to somebody in a private school. Should not our goals be the same for all children? Yes, we do have a Tort Claims Act that limits the time to sue a public entity, and thus we have treated public and private sector somewhat differently. But HB 2827 widens that gulf by 22 years. When enacting public policy on child abuse, our goal should be to provide similar opportunities for all children, not to enhance the discriminatory effects of our existing laws. Studies have shown that the incidence of child abuse in public schools dwarf the levels of abuse in religious schools. House Bill 2827 does not protect the largest segment of the at-risk Oregon population, those children in public schools. It is also fundamentally unfair in that it allows and encourages people to sit on their rights. Even someone who knows that he or she has been harmed by child abuse can wait for years to bring a civil claim. My husband has been a volunteer coach for the 14 and 15-year-old boys. House Bill 2827 would allow one of the kids he coached to wait 25 years to bring a claim. My husband, if alive, would be 85. How would he defend against a false claim like that? How would we, his family, or his estate defend against such a false claim? There was a suggestion this morning that the Archdiocese's only interest in House Bill 2827 is financial, and a question was posed rhetorically, why would the Archdiocese oppose this bill? The Archdiocese opposes HB 2827 because of its fundamental unfairness. The accused as well as the accuser has rights. The deck is stacked against anyone accused of criminal activity that allegedly occurred 30, 40, or 50 years ago. In addition, as my colleague pointed out, HB 2827 is retroactive. HB 2827 is not aimed at punishing perpetrators. Indeed, it is likely that the longer one waits to bring a claim, the more likely the accused or the falsely accused will be dead. The net effect will be to leave employers and sponsors on the hook with no practical ability to defend themselves. After 40 years, memories of faded, witnesses are deceased, and documents are destroyed. We should all work towards eradicating child abuse and toward providing assistance to those who have been victimized by it. Thoughtful public policy should go into any new form of legislation. If there are changes that should be made to existing laws, there should be open hearings where testimony can be taken from all segments of society. Legislation of this magnitude should not be rushed through the system. My client, the Archdiocese, is committed to making its parishes and schools safe for all children. The Archdiocese has developed a comprehensive written child abuse policy addressing the prevention of, reporting of, and response to child abuse. The Archdiocese is ready and willing to work with this committee to help create good, sound public policy pertaining to child abuse issues. I submit that HB 2827 does not reflect sound public policy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Pazanski and committee members, thank you. My name is Mark Siegel. I'm the Volunteer Executive Director of the Oregon Federation of Independent Schools, the Oregon Private School Community. And again, we want to be very clear. We do not tolerate child abuse, abuse of children in any form, and we want to punish all wrongdoers, get them out of the schools, get them so that they're not harming children. To that end, our members are staying trained. It's a topic of our fall kickoff meeting. As you're aware, Senate Bill 379 out of the 2007 session mandated all Oregon teachers, parents, and students in K-12 public and private schools receive annual training on both prevention and identification of child abuse. And, of course, schools are doing much more than just meeting that statutory requirement to care for the children in their care. We want to see anyone who harms children removed from the system as soon as possible and punished to the full extent of the law. Harming children is inexcusable, and we don't tolerate it. We object to House Bill 2827 because this law is just bad public policy. It's unfair because it doesn't affect the majority of children who are in the public schools. It only aims at private organizations. It will vastly decrease the willingness of parents and other volunteers to help us in our classrooms and programs, and make schools much less willing to take on volunteers, which has typically been quite a component in our school delivery. Extending the incident reporting time prevents private schools and other nonprofit organizations from taking prompt, effective action to stop wrongdoers in their tracks and prevent them from continuing their harmful acts. And changing the statute of limitations needs a very deliberative process. They exist for a reason. They've proven their need, their workability. And change in longstanding legal policy like this needs full and deliberate discussion to fully explore all the effects. And as noted, retroactive laws are inherently unfair, just like moving the goalposts mid-game. Again, the Oregon Federation of Independent Schools supports good policy that prevents and detects child abuse as soon as possible. This bill before you is bad policy and should not be adopted in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Oops. Chair Pazanski, members of the committee, good afternoon, and thank you for making it possible for us to testify here. My name is Ken McLeod. I live in Sheridan. I'm the president of Tri-Cities Little League, which serves Sheridan, Willamina, and Grand Rond. Although Little League has no tolerance for child abuse, I have, in any form, I've submitted written testimony in opposition to House Bill 2827. I won't repeat it here, but I would like to make the following points. One, we are a volunteer organization. It's hard enough to get volunteers at the best of times. But if this bill passes, it exposes volunteers to possible litigation many, many, many years later for a few weeks of community service, something that would make it even more difficult for us to recruit volunteers and continue to provide the service to the community. Two, if the bill passes, it will allow wrongdoers to remain in the system for long periods. We'd rather have legislation that helps root them out at the earliest possible opportunity. Three, the bill unfairly targets only the private sector, whereas a large portion of Oregon's youth participates in public schools and public school programs. And this is an inherent flaw, I think, in this proposed legislation, and we therefore oppose it. And I'd like to thank you very much for the opportunity, and I'm done.
All right, thank you. Colleagues, any questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Wissett first.
Mr. Trister, what's the burden of proof?
I'm going to defer to Ms. Hoffman.
In a civil case, it's by a preponderance of the evidence.
51%.
I'm sorry?
51%?
No. More likely than not. If you had two scales together, they're equal, you put a feather on one, that much would be sufficient. So it's 50 plus some.
Okay, 50 points in infinite. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Another question. Would this bill include children in foster care where they were, at least part of their care was being funded by the state?
No.
And third question, Mr. Chair, this is a shared liability, so if you have an individual who is volunteering with an organization or working for an organization, that individual and the organization, whichever had the deeper pockets, would be sued.
If you're asking me, my experience is both people would be sued.
That's what I mean, yes.
Both people would be sued.
Yes. Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Thank you very much for coming forward. That is all the individuals I have scheduled. That's on the witness registration. I do want to ask if there are a number of people that are here earlier today, if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2827. Not seeing anyone come forward. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2827. And at this point, I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2827.
Mr. Chair, I move 2827A without recommendation of the Committee on Rules.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2827A to the President's office for consideration of being referred to the Committee on Rules with a no recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, just that we heard some compelling testimony, but we also heard some serious concerns, and to address something like this in such a short time, I think would be problematic. So I'll support the move to rules and without recommendation. Thank you.
Any other comments? The Chair would like to make a few comments. I agree with Senator Volamici. This is extremely complex legislation. And it's one that we can need to take deliberative action in making decisions as to before we move forward. I will tell you, I do find a few things unnerving for me as the chair of this committee, receiving emails from groups such as the Winter Wish List Foundation, or Wish Foundation, that state that the measure has been reportedly bogged down in the Senate because of political pressure from religious groups, including Catholic Church, Mormon Church, the Senate President Peter Courtney or Chair Przanski. I will tell you there is nobody who's put any pressure on me as chair as to what I'm going to do with this bill or not do with this bill. As a prosecutor who has actually prosecuted child abuse cases, I find that very offensive. I've also had a family member who suffered, as many of these people have testified today. But we have to be deliberative in our process, and we cannot rush without having the opportunity to do that. Because of that, I will, in fact, support the motion that's before us. Any other comments? So ordered. All right, we'll go off the record for a moment so we get the other count. Thank you. Thank you. We're back on the record. We've substituted counsel here, and we're going to start with the other two that Shannon has, which I believe we're going to start with House Bill 2339A. So I'll reopen the work session on this bill.
House Bill 2339A, we visited this morning and adopted the A5 amendments. However, upon taking a closer look at it, it appeared that the definition of financial institutions that had been drafted into the A5 amendment was too restrictive, and they were able to redraft it in LC. So you have A6 amendments in front of you, and all they do is on page 132, or subsection 32, it notes that the financial institution as defined by ORS 706.008 and a consumer finance company is licensed under ORS Chapter 725, mortgage bankers or mortgage brokers licensed under ORS Chapter 59, or title companies for business purposes, which gives it a broader definition, which was the initial intent. As a result, however, we have to rescind the adoption of the dash fives, adopt the dash sixes, and then move the vote out.
We don't need to reconsider because it hasn't left the committee, have we? We just need to rescind.
That sounds right.
Yeah. Okay, Mr. Chair, I move that the A5s, as previously adopted, be removed from 2339. Oh, no, from. Yeah, that's right. Okay, I got the wrong staff here. 2339A.
Let me just make it clear. I think we might want to rule. I'm not sure if we need a rule suspension on this or not.
Okay, let's just do it.
Let's just do that to be safe.
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules for the intent of removing an amendment from 2339 previously adopted in the existing committee session.
All right.
Up today.
Just to be safe here, we're going to go through a parliamentary process here. Senator Boquist has moved that we suspend the rules if necessary to reconsider the adoption of an amendment in House Bill 2339A. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move that we remove the A5 amendment from House Bill 2339A.
Senator Boquist moves that we remove the A5s from House Bill 2339. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, just for clarification from Council, the purpose of this is to define what financial institutions are under the for purposes of the bill?
Yes. Okay. That's correct.
All right, and any other comments? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, move the A6 into 2339A.
All right, Senator Boquist moves that we adopt the A6s in the House Bill 2339. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, question to Council. Council, can you tell us about the fiscal statement? Is the A6 the same as the A5 fiscal statement? Would it be less or more?
The A6 is the same as the A5. The A5 official document was not drafted in time. You do have the numbers, though, as put forth by the clerks, and that is what I believe will be reflected in the final fiscal statement.
Yes, we don't have that final fiscal statement.
No, we don't.
Okay.
But that would be taken directly from the clerk's accounting of what they cost, and I believe it was approximately $123,000 for the year.
Can I ask a question? $123,000 statewide or in each county or what? We didn't get a copy of that.
Oh, I want your attention.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules for the fiscal statement.
Senator Boquist.
HB 339 as applies to the A6 amendments.
Senator Boquist moves that we suspend the rules for consideration of the A6s or the adoption of House Bill 2339 with the A6s.
And to my motion, Mr. Chair.
And to your motion.
No, I'll go ahead and suspend the rules first.
All right. Is there any discussion? Any objection?
Mr. Chair, I don't have an objection. Not a strong objection. I don't like the bill very well. It is an unfunded mandate, but it is a smaller unfunded mandate than we were going to do before. If the clerks are all right with it, if the clerks have had their arm sufficiently broken to accept it, we'll go along with it.
I hope that didn't happen. I saw them both walk up here. They looked like they had use of both their arms. and they didn't seem to be cobbling, so I don't think any nightsticks were used or anything like that.
No.
So any other objection?
Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry.
I just want to put in the... what's the pending motion right now?
The pending motion is to suspend the rules.
Okay. If you want to wait till after we suspend
okay,
the rules.
Okay, that's fine.
All right, so we're going to go ahead and suspend the rules. So ordered. And
Mr. Chair, I'll move HB 2339A as amended by the A6 to the floor with the due pass, and I'll speak to my motion. I believe there's others who want to speak to the motion.
And before you conclude your motion, do you want this to be reviewed by the President's office just to see if there is, by that time, something on the fiscal that would require it's county?
Yes,
so I don't.
Sure.
All right, so I'm just going to put on the motion. Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2339 as amended by the A6s to the floor with a due pass recommendation with asking the President's office to review the bill to determine whether or not it needs to go to Ways and Means because we do not currently have a fiscal before us. To that discussion, Senator
Mr. Chair,
Boquist.
I don't believe there's a state fiscal on it. It is, in fact, a sort of an unfunded mandate, as was stated by Senator Whipset. With that, I'll yield my time to Senator Bonamici.
All right, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to put on the record as well that we don't have the fiscal on this, and the clerks did submit something saying that the statewide fiscal total would be at least $129,000. Realistically, the statewide total would probably be closer to $500,000 for employee research of records that the public was once able to research on their own. So there's a lot of uncertainties. I think that there's some good policy in the bill, but at this particular time for our counties, I think that could be problematic.
All right. And the other thing I do want to put on the record, now that I have looked at the A6s, council did tell me that there may be an issue with one of the on line 10 of the A6s as to having the word as the name to be excluded. What I've stated to council, what I will put on the record for everyone that's here today, is that because of the lateness of time, because we don't have any time to get another amendment, this bill will be moving forward if it passes here, and if it goes back over to the and it will go over to the House for concurrence. If the chair of the Judiciary Committee chooses to not concur, which I expect that he will, that we will look at that issue through a conference committee if it's still an issue. This will allow for the bill to move forward and allow those who are engaged and involved for as proponents or opponents to the bill, or those who are neutral, to look at the A6s and to determine whether or not there is, in fact, a problem. With that said, is there any other comments? If not, any objection? So ordered. And on this one here, since it's going to the floor, we need a carrier and...
Mr. Chair. Okay.
Senator Boquist will be our carrier on 2339. Thank you. We'll close the work session on 2339. We'll open the work session or continue our work session on House Bill 2441.
Members of the committee, on 2441, I believe several of us have notations on our files that the A5s and A7s were adopted the May 21st, I believe was the date. However, in going back through some of the logs, it's a technical matter. We simply do not have an accurate log that reflects that within the Judiciary Office, and we need to maintain that. So in an excess of caution, we could re-adopt the A5s and A7s and then again repass the bill, and then we'll be done.
All right. So basically at this point, the chair will entertain a motion. The first amendment is A5. On the A5s into... let's think about this. I think we need to back up on that. Yep.
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules for possible reconsideration of HB 2441 as previously adopted in a previous session today.
Yeah. Senator Boquist moves that we suspend the rules to allow the committee to reconsider the vote that passed House Bill 2441 out of committee. I believe it was scheduled to go to rules. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Chair, in light of the discussion from legal counsel, I move the A5 into 2441.
All right. Senator Boquist, out of a caution certainty here, we're going to move the dash
A5s into House Bill 2441. Any discussion?
Just for the record, I have my notes on the 21st. We did this.
All right. And also, I know Senator Bonamici had some notes that it looked like it was a different.
We, yeah.
So it appears that we did, but this will be our third time. Any objection to the dash five A5s? Not? So ordered.
Chair, I move the A7s into 2441.
Senator Boquist now moves the A7s into House Bill 2441. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2441A as amended with the A5s and the A7s be referred to the President's office for further referral to rules.
All right, Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2441 as amended by the A5s and A7s to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Did you have a recommendation?
No recommendation. I just want to make sure. I think I missed that.
Don't think he had one in his mouth.
I didn't have a recommendation.
Okay, I apologize. So
no,
let's just restate.
I possible enough, so no recommendation.
Right. Without recommendation, with the referral to the President's office for consideration of referring this to rules. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And as I see Judy walks in, it always makes me stop and wonder.
Am I doing it wrong, madam?
Go on, recess for a moment. Yeah, don't leave yet. All right, we're back on the record, and we just got clarification, even though we've been super cautious and making sure that we did everything procedurally right. We're probably over-cautious because we did not need to be suspending the rules for bills that were still in our possession for the day. So, but with that, Shannon has concluded her work with us with the Senate Judiciary Committee. And so I want to take this time to thank you very, very much for all the work that you've done for us and with us and helping direct us and guide us through the trials and tribulations of the bills that have come from the House as well as the ones that you've worked from the Senate side. And I assume that you will be returning to possible prior employment if they haven't closed your position.
If they'll have me, yes.
Yes. And so thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senators. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
We won't see your accomplishment.
You never know. All right. So with that, Mr. Taylor is now on board. And all right, so we're going to start with reopen the work session on House Bill 2290.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee may remember earlier this morning we adopted a whole series of sets of amendments on, and actually there was a little bit of redundancy in here. The A13 include all the other amendments that we adopted, so we no harm, no foul with the same spot. You have the A13 amendments here. They've been adopted as part of the other group. Chairman of the committee, I guess the only thing left to do would be to
take a motion.
Bill, there's no fiscal. We don't have a fiscal yet, right?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, I believe what I received
was minimal fiscal impact from the amendments.
2290.
The communication that I received earlier. Can we check that? Yeah.
I have a question.
I received emails, and Tim was up to my office, so.
Right. Go ahead, Senator.
We adopted several amendments already to this bill.
Yes, we did, six like
amendments.
6 through
okay.
13, and it turns out the 13 that
it
came
included
in.
Included them all.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we've been over.
We've hit this one twice.
Yeah.
Right. What are we waiting for?
Fiscal. Somebody ask a question on fiscal.
All right. Senator,
I know it has no revenue. I did receive that.
Senator Bonamici is finished with her questions and comments.
And so we do have a fiscal. We need to suspend the rules for fiscal to Senate because we're going to rules, right?
Yep.
Okay, Bill, tell us why here.
There he is.
Do we need to get rid of these? Or?
No, it's okay. There's no conflict.
There's no conflict.
Okay.
And hot off the press.
You just tell us when he's coming. Oh, these formalities. You got to pass it to him. It's like a secret handshake.
It really is.
Chairman of the committee, the fiscal is a minimal as it was when we came here, too.
Okay. All right. So apparently the report on the fiscal is minimal. And, yes.
Mr. Chair, I move 2290A as amended with all those things, but mainly the A13, be referred to the President's office for potential referral onto Rules Committee with a due pass. Thank you.
All right. So Senator Boquist moves that House Bill 2290, as amended by the multiple A amendments, but specifically the A13s, with the due pass recommendation to the President's office for consideration for referral to the Rules Committee. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And we'll close the work session on 2290A. And we'll open the work session on House Bill 2335A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in this morning on House Bill 2335A, we adopted the A22 amendments to the bill. Subsequent to the meeting, Doug Hawthorne came by and pointed out, let me go to page 24 of the bill, and that certain crimes were, as it relates to people being eligible for 10% more during credit time, were considered violent offenders. And let me find that provision in the bill if I can. Right. On page 24 of the A23 amendments, it says, notwithstanding subsection A of this section, the maximum amount of time credits earned for appropriate institutional behavior for participants in adult basic skills development program may not exceed 20% terms if the inmate is serving a sentence for, and it lists crimes. If we had A through C this morning. He pointed out, and I checked with you and Representative Barker, that it was the intent of the work group to include within not allowing the additional 10% for someone convicted of criminally negligent homicide, assault in the third degree, assault in the fourth degree, where it constitutes a felony, that's domestic violence, and any attempt to those particular crimes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. That is the main difference to the bill. There's some clarifications on page 25, starting at lines 26 through 28. But that's, as I said, that's the main policy difference
right. From
this bill. Tim was nice enough to bring up expeditiously a fiscal impact statement of the Dash 22 amendments. We don't have one for the Dash 23 because we just got the amendments a little while ago. So,
the rules, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Okay. Let's get the 22 out. We're going to take 22 out. Take 22 out first.
Yes.
Well, this is a new one. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which the A22 amendments dated 5/28/09 were adopted earlier today.
Senator Boquist moves that we reconsider the vote that was taken that adopted the A22s in the House Bill 2335 earlier today. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, if we could just get a little clarification. So the difference between in the 23s, it just adds additional the E, F, and G, and those are the crimes for which there cannot be.
This relates to earned credit time, and it would prohibit these people from receiving 10% additional earned credit time. They are eligible for 20% within the institution. We are, for a certain population, making them eligible for additional 10%.
Understood.
So that means they have to abide by the rules of the institution. And
so were these were added here, but were they did they need to be taken out somewhere else?
No. This is a carve-out, meaning when I say carve-out, as to those who would not be able to get the additional 10% that going from 20% earned credit time to 30%. Unfortunately, in the rush to get the A22s together, part of the list that we had agreed to during the work group was, let's say, not included. One of the individuals who reviewed the Dash 22s brought that to Mr. Taylor's attention earlier today, who then in turn brought it to my attention as well as Chair Barker's. And we agreed that, what the intention was, in fact, to include those as excluding them from getting that additional amount. And because of that, since we knew the bill was coming back before us or was still in our possession, that it would be best to go ahead and clarify it now instead of waiting for it to get to rules and do it there. And so that's what it
Thank you
includes.
For that clarification.
All right. Any other? Senator Whitsett, sorry.
Chair Pisanski, for questions for counsel. We have a Dash 18, Amendment A18. That's not in this bill, is it?
A18?
Chair Members of Committee, I don't remember what this A18 was.
It would charge the county half the cost of the cap.
That is not in the bill.
Thank you.
No. Yes. So, yeah, there are a number of things that were being, let's say, considered or potentially proposed that was not brought in. The A18s are not part of the bill as it stands now.
I didn't find it in the bill. I wanted to make sure it wasn't in it.
Yeah, and the chair has no intention of moving that into this bill.
Thank you.
All right. So that leaves us at this point.
Take the gavel and say there's take a vote. Take a vote. Right, okay. So the A22 is out, right?
A22 is out, and now.
Chair, I move the A23 into HB 2335A.
All right, Senator Boquist moves the A23s into House Bill 2335. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
And Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that we're going to move this on to rules. So, Senator Whitsett. So we should probably discuss removing, passing it out without a fiscal.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, concerning that, I move that we suspend the rules on the requirement for a fiscal on 2335A as amended by the 23.
All right. Senator Boquist moves that we suspend the rules for the purposes of advancing the bill as amended to the President's office for assignment or reassignment to the Committee on Rules. Any discussion? Any objection?
That's the fiscal.
On the fiscal. Right. Yep. Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2335A as amended by the A3 be sent to the President's office for reassignment or consideration for assignment to rules.
Okay, if I've got that right, the motion is that we move House Bill 2335 as amended by the A23s to the President's office for consideration of referral to rules with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. All right. So, does that take care of everything on
the committee? I think that takes care of everything.
Thank you.
It's in there. It's all in there. Yeah. It's just included. Added. All right. So, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2335. And at this time, I want to just take a few moments. I know it's after 5 o'clock, but I want to thank everyone on the committee and also all of our staff and all the support. Not everyone is in the room. Hopefully those that are in the Judiciary Committee office are hearing us. I want to thank Courtney for all of her work that she's done and keeping us online, keeping all the records that we need to do our business. Anna, thank you very, very much. Council Bill here, as always, has always been a strong force to be able to work with and to be able to have the guidance and understanding. And to my committee members, I don't have the numbers in front of me. I expect that we will have another time to get together. But what I can tell you from the preliminary numbers I saw, we actually covered and handled more House bills in basically a 4-week period plus the ones that trickled in prior to that than we did Senate bills. So if anyone over in the House tells you that we didn't do our job when it came to their bills, tell them pure poppycock. All right. We could ask for the percentage of where we're at now, but again, thank you all very much. I know this last week and a half has been much more taxing, but I believe what the work that we did was very beneficial for the legislature and hopefully the citizens of the state. Any other comments?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to thank you for your leadership on this committee, and I have to say that it seems like every morning when I got here and every night when I left, you were still here. So your hard work has not gone unnoticed, and I appreciate everything that you've done for the committee.
I was going to say we were off biking in between then, so thank you. You're here the whole time.
Okay. Getting the blood flowing. All right. Nothing else. Thank you all very much, and we're adjourned.
We'll look forward to it.